Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The usual two segments today. First, in a minute or so, Katha Pollitt will talk about her book, Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights. And just after the half-hour mark, the labor historian Raquel Varela will talk about the dimensions of Portugal's economic crisis. First, Katha Pollitt. Pollitt is a columnist for The Nation magazine, a poet, and the author of Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights, published by Picador. Too often, defenders of abortion rights are all too defensive, conceding ground to opponents and saying little about the positive benefits of terminating an unwanted pregnancy. They've also been relying on lobbying and litigation, and not enough on organizing. This is deeply unfortunate. To the right, limiting and ultimately banning abortion is part of a long-range strategy to restrict the freedom of women to live, work, and have sex with men as they please. Sometimes it seems like the right is a lot better at thinking things through and working tirelessly for them, and the left is half-hearted and confused. This is one of those cases. Katha Pollitt, however, does not suffer from that unfortunate inhibition. Pro is a lively, thoughtful, and informative book that makes the positive case for, as people used to say back in the 70s, before the reactionaries mobilized, free abortion on demand, no questions asked. If you're uncertain about this issue, or if you're looking for good arguments for the cause, or if you just want to read a well-written and well-argued case for reproductive rights, you can't do better than Pro. Katha Pollitt. Welcome, Katha. Let's start by reviewing the history of how we got to Roe v. Wade. You know, people think that it came out of nowhere, but in fact, there was quite a prehistory to it, right?
Well, there was. Beginning in really the early 60s, a number of things happened that made people rethink the almost total ban on abortion that existed. One was the case of Sherry Finkbein, who got German measles during a pregnancy and wanted to end the pregnancy, but when the media found out about it, she wasn't able to do that. And she went very publicly to Sweden in order not to have a child that would have been born with terrible, terrible medical problems. And then there was an epidemic of German measles, and a lot of women became aware at that point of how at risk their pregnancies were. And these were middle-class white women who were married. They were very respectable. And that got people thinking a little bit about how, you know, abortion was a larger story than simply we have to prevent loose women from doing what they want. So by the time Roe v. Wade came along in 1973, there were several states that had liberalized their laws, New York, for example, and California, where then-Governor Ronald Reagan signed what was then the most liberal law in the country. So things were beginning to shake up, and doctors were also a very important part of the story, because the laws meant that doctors could not take care of their patients well. They couldn't, if a woman had cancer, there are all kinds of situations in which doctors would have wanted to end the pregnancy of their patient in order to take care of her. And this was very hard for them to do. One other thing that played a role was there were hospital committees that sort of judge, it was like queen for a day, you know, where you'd win a refrigerator if you told the most woeful story, an old TV program. So with the hospital committees, you could go before them and you could make your case, or your doctor would make your case, why you deserved to end your pregnancy. These were so unfair and they were so humiliating, where, was, of course, the relatives of doctors had a good chance. Married, white, very respectable women had a good chance. Teenagers had a very bad chance, unless they were the daughters of the very respectable. It was just humiliating all around, and it made the unfairness of the existing situation in which many, not all, but many well-off women were able to get safe illegal abortions, it made that all the more obvious.
Do we have any good numbers on just how common illegal abortions were in the pre-Roe days?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question because the anti-choicers, of course, say it was quite rare. The fact is, it's very hard to know how often something happens if it's a crime. But Mary Calderon, who was then the medical director, I think, of Planned Parenthood, convened in the late 50s or possibly 1960. She convened a whole bunch of doctors and demographers to study this very question. And the most common number that they came up with, according to her, was 1 million a year, which is incredible when you consider how much smaller the population was than now. I mean, now it's around 1 million a year, a little more, but the population was much smaller. So that certainly suggests that it was very, very common.
And going back into the misty realms of prehistory, in the 19th century, abortions were legal. The founding fathers didn't write about abortion. And even the Catholic Church didn't ban abortion until well into the 19th century, right?
Well, they sort of did. That what they didn't do was codify it as murder and you could be excommunicated for it. But they were pretty much always against it, but it was more as a sexual sin. It was connected more with sexuality than with the idea that the fertilized egg, which nobody knew existed in the 19th century, was a person from the moment of conception. But it's true that except in Connecticut and New York, abortion was legal in the United States until after the Civil War. And then the same wave of suppression of women that made birth control illegal, the Comstock laws, not just birth control, but information about birth control became illegal. And that was when abortion became criminalized. But when George Washington was the president, he and Martha could have had all the abortions they wanted.
But there is also something to do with the medical profession establishing itself, its legitimacy and trying to put the kibosh on midwives.
Yeah, there were a lot of things that happened at once. And one of them, as you point out, was the medical profession, which we think of, course, very ancient, but in its modern incarnation is pretty new. They wanted to have control of pregnancy and childbirth, and they didn't like the midwives who were often immigrant women who were performing abortions often on an immigrant population. And so they made a whole campaign about how dangerous abortion was. But at the same time, another thing that was happening was that, again, white middle-class women were having fewer children. And when you think of this, Doug, it's really kind of amazing. In 1800, the average number of children per woman in America was almost 8. By 1900, it was 4. So without any modern methods of birth control, people managed to cut their fertility in half. How did they do that? Well, they had a lot of different things that they did, but abortion was a very important part of that story. And there was, at that time, a great fear that, oh, no, what was it called, race suicide. White people aren't having enough babies. And it wasn't so much about black people. It was about having more babies. It was about immigrants, and especially Catholic immigrants. So it was the idea that the old Protestant stock, Yankee stock, was being outbred by Irish and Italian, et cetera, Catholics. And then doctors were really into that. They really bought into that kind of race suicide, white people must breed mentality. So it was a whole lot of things coming together. It's interesting because at that time, there really was kind of a lot of feminism about in the post-Civil War era. And women were starting clubs. They were getting involved in social work. They were getting out of the house and trying to be bigger players in public life. And also, people wanted to have a little fun. They didn't want to, get married, have your 8 children. So there really was this feeling of like, oh no, the women are getting out of hand. We've got to get them doing the right thing, having those kids.
I was just about to ask a question, and then I realized we haven't really clarified the language question. Pro-life, pro-choice, what terminology? It's a minefield.
Well, in my book, I I did not use the term pro-life except to refer to the pro-life movement, the political pro-life movement, because it's propaganda language, and I call them abortion opponents, although that's very cumbersome. But I just don't want to encourage the conscious or unconscious connection of what seems to me a very anti-life movement with, or a fetishizing of the unborn life to the exclusion of everybody else. I didn't want to promote that. So I call them anti-choice. I noticed I said that earlier. That's a little snarky. They really don't like it when you refer to them that way.
Okay, the anti-choice or the abortion opponents have done what is really a clever thing politically by focusing all their attention on the fetus or the pre-born child, right? And women get erased in this picture.
Yes. Well, women get erased in that picture according to us. But according to them, women do not get erased because women are made very, very unhappy if they have an abortion. They're at great risk of being maimed and dying. They are violating their nature. As one abortion opponent said to me, how can it not harm a woman to kill her child? So from their perspective, they are not anti-woman.
Now, of course, there's no empirical evidence for any psychological or physical damage from having an abortion.
No, no. You know, it's very interesting. Ronald Reagan, when he, the person who signed the then most liberal abortion law in the country, when he became president and became an abortion opponent, he asked his Surgeon General, Everett Koop, to make the case, basically, that abortion harmed women psychologically. And Everett Koop was not only an evangelical Christian, but he was also anti-choice. But he was also a good doctor and a, you know, cared about science and evidence. And he went and he looked at all the literature and he said, you know, I can't do this. It's really not there. Every neutral group that has looked at this issue has said, you know, well, you know, some women greatly regret their abortion. But in general, the main feeling women feel is relief and feelings of sadness and such are usually transient. So there it is. Now, in my book, if I can just go on a little bit, I talk about this whole idea that whether something should be legal or not should depend on how some women feel about it. I think this seems very strange to me. Some people regret, you can regret almost everything people do. People regret their divorces. People regret whether they went to the college they went to. They regret the jobs they went into. Maybe some people regret having children. That's the real taboo. You can't say that. But the fact that people regret something is not a reason to make it illegal.
Okay. Now returning to the fetus, this attention on the fetus though is we have these personhood amendments created. You know, declaring life begins at conception. Does this really mean anything?
What do you mean by that?
The notion that life begins at conception, in what sense is the fetus life?
You know, this is the thing. There's this confusion between life and personhood. Of course, a new life is started when the fertilized egg implants in the womb. And that's when everybody but the anti-abortion people call pregnancy. To them, pregnancy begins with the fertilization of the egg. But there's a big difference between life and a person, isn't there? Because a person is a lot more than that. It's very strange to see, very hard to see as a person something that has no recognizable human features. It doesn't have a head. It doesn't have a brain. It doesn't have arms and legs. It has no social relationships. It has no consciousness. It has no emotions. It doesn't have any of the qualities that a person has. But is it alive? Yes, it's alive.
I'm speaking with Katha Pollitt, the Nation columnist and author of Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights from Picador. The anti-abortion people often make exceptions for cases of rape or incest. At the same time, they call abortion murder and use all these Holocaust analogies. And what is the logic of making that exception?
I think the real logic is political. It's that they have to make these exceptions because there's a significant number of people who would go ballistic if they didn't. But the real reason, and here I have to say, of course, it's completely true that if you believe the fertilized egg, embryo, fetus is a person just like you or me, you can't make these exceptions. You know, you can't do that. So they're really violating their own logic and professed belief there. But I think the real reason why people feel, yeah, rape is different, is that if you have all the exceptions to abortion bans are related either to extreme medical situations or whether or not you had voluntary sex. That's what it's all about. So the rape fetus dies because his mother didn't have voluntary sex. The woman who had sex willingly, she's not allowed to have an abortion. So that's where you really see that what this is all about is women and sex.
Yeah, this is really getting to the nub of the issue, which is controlling women and their sexuality.
Yes, completely. I mean, I think that there are a lot of people who think, oh, the world is going to hell in a handbasket. You know, I just can't stand it. Everybody's just acting up. Where are the old values? People are so irresponsible. They use abortion as birth control. They shouldn't be running around like they do. And that's sort of where, beyond the religious objections to abortion on the part of a few religions, most religions, I have to say in parentheses, permit abortion under certain circumstances. But there's this idea that letting sex just be frequent and letting people do what they want, this is a very bad idea. I was on the radio in Minnesota with a woman who is a law professor at a Catholic college, and she said the reason there's so much abortion is people have no self-control. And I said, well, but what about married people? They're supposed to have sex. And she said, oh, married women don't have abortions. And three women called the station immediately to say that they had had abortions as married women. But that's the kind of thinking that it's just people running wild and doing what they want. Can't have that.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, the Roe v. Wade came out in 1973. The Equal Rights Amendment was circulating in the 70s. Opposition to these things were really central to the mobilization of the new right in the 1970s. So the control of women and resistance to all their claims for equality and freedom are really very central to this right-wing backlash now we're 40 years into.
Yes, it's really part of the reactionary DNA. You're right that there's another thing about when Roe v. Wade was passed, we were really seeing a rise in women's liberation in every area. And that was, you know, it's very interesting if you think, now, why did these Supreme Court justices, these seven out of nine, you know, conservative, older guys, the majority of whom had been nominated by Republicans, why did they go for Roe v. Wade? And I think the world looked different to them in that they looked around, they saw, look, polls show women, people favor legal abortion. We've got the Equal Rights Amendment. We've got women entering the professions. They were very aware of how by that time it was pretty much only poor and minority women who were stuck with illegal abortion because they couldn't get to New York. So they were looking at a world that looked like it was really progressing in terms of women's rights. And I think the abortion decision was in that context.
And now let's talk some about the pro-choice movement, the reproductive freedom movement. It is really woefully underorganized compared to the anti-abortion movement. And as you point out, you know, if you wanted to go work for abortion rights somewhere, you wouldn't even know where to go. If you wanted to work against them, you'd have no problem at all.
Yes, the anti-abortion people have enormous advantages, and one of them is the churches. It's a place everybody goes there. You know, you go there on Sunday, you meet the other anti-choice people, then after you have your cake and coffee, you write your letter to the your congressman, or you start a diaper drive to donate to the birthright people down the block. It is really a grassroots movement. I think this is something that we have to admit. This is not just coming from the top. It's also a way, there's many, many ways for ordinary people to be involved at a level that is comfortable for them. And the pro-choice movement doesn't really have that natural way of getting together. And so you have to really want to be a very active activist to do more than just write a check to Planned Parenthood, which is a good thing to do, but it's not going to make the difference.
Well, there's also an issue of people who are against abortion are very, very passionate about the cause and very dedicated to it. A lot of people who support the right to choose are not quite so impassioned.
It's really true. If you look at who is a single-issue voter, the anti-abortion people are many times more likely to have that be the deciding issue for them when they think about how to vote than the pro-choice people. And I think one reason for that is, well, there's, you know, religion always makes people very dedicated and passionate. I think another reason is that it's very energizing to feel that you have to overturn something, you have to change the law, you have to bring your truth into the public realm. And pro-choice people can be pretty complacent. They won. Abortion is legal. And the brilliant way that the anti-choicers have organized their plans is to do this thing where it's the death of a thousand cuts. It's restrictions that make it harder for women to get to the clinic. It ratchets up the price, restrictions on clinics that make the clinics close. And when they went for the Human Life Amendment 20 years ago, which would have been a federal ban on all abortion, they didn't get very far with that. And that's the same problem with these personhood amendments that you mentioned earlier. It's so extreme, it kind of wakes people up. And also it extends to birth control and it extends to in vitro fertilization, you know, which kills lots of embryos and so on. But when they do these little things, people don't really understand how serious they are. Also, they're happening in the red states where most pro-choice people don't live there. I mean, there's a geographical factor to this that is now breaking down because now we're having a lot of, you know, restrictions in Virginia, restrictions in Ohio, in Pennsylvania. But as long as it's North Dakota, it's easy for people to say, well, okay, but North Dakota.
Yeah, well, there are now many, many jurisdictions where abortion is effectively illegal or effectively unavailable.
Yes, there are. There are six or seven states that have only one clinic. Wyoming has no clinics. And there are many, many clinics have closed in the last 3 years. And there have been hundreds of new restrictions that have been passed and hundreds more that have been proposed. It really is reaching a crisis point in many parts of the country. I mean, if you look at Texas, they had, before this all started, they had a little over 40 clinics. Now it's down to less than half of that, including none in a very broad swath of Texas in the Rio Grande Valley, where you would have to travel for hours and hours and hours to get to a clinic.
And pro-choice side seems very, very ready to make compromises. The abortion they'll concede on the emotionally wrenching issue. They'll concede they'll say that abortion should be safe, legal, and rare, as if there's something wrong with it. There's no real full-throated defense of the right to abortion as some kind of foundation of human freedom.
Well, I think that's changing. I think that I talk about this in the book, that the pro-choice movement has been kind of reactive rather than proactive. So it's the other side, the anti-abortion people say, pregnant women who are thinking about abortions, they're so, such an emotional time, they're so confused, they're being bullied by their boyfriends, so we need to slow it all down. We need to have waiting periods and mandated counseling and all kinds of stuff like that. And then our side says, no, women take this decision very seriously. They think about it a lot. It's the most painful, wrenching, agonizing decision a woman ever makes. And they're trying to counterbalance that picture of women as flighty and confused. But what it ends up doing is adding to the stigma of abortion. Because it's really saying, yeah, you know, this is really something you ought to find very wrenching. And if you don't, there's something wrong with you. It's unintentional, but it's part of the way, the larger way, that the pro-choice movement has had a hard time taking the initiative back from the anti-choice people. But I'm happy to say that I think pro, my book, is part of a wave of challenging that way of thinking, and that now you're finding a lot of younger activists are very out front, very much challenging that. There are websites where women tell their abortion stories. There's Emily Letts videoed her abortion to show people that it wasn't, you know, look, the clinic is clean. Look, I'm not in agony. Look, it takes 3 minutes. And there's been a lot of that. Another thing is emphasizing birth control, which is kind of the little sister in all of this, because the anti-abortion people are doing what it was predicted by pro-choice people was they were going to do, which is now they say birth control is abortion. You know, the IUD is an abortion, the birth control pill is an abortion, emergency contraception is an abortion. So you see where they're going with this. And I think it's really, really great and important that the pro-choice movement is talking about long-acting reversible contraception as something that really should be much more widespread than it is, and looking at the reasons why it isn't, which have to do with cost and doctors not being trained to give it and all that kind of thing. And I think we're seeing that change.
And at the end of the book, you talk about the importance of the pro-choice movement linking up with a broader social justice agenda.
Yes, I think, you know, this is called reproductive justice, and which is often presented as it's one of these heated rhetorical wars that the progressive movement seems so prone to. But reproductive justice is really a better framing than choice, because choice basically says, you have a decision to have a baby or not. That's your right. And that all ends at birth. Whereas reproductive justice is a bigger puts it in a bigger framework of, what do you need to raise a child well? What do you need to be healthy? What does a community need to do for mothers and for children? And it's a really great advance for the pro-choice movement, because it draws in, it has the potential to draw in people who, for whom whether or not they can legally end a pregnancy isn't the only issue. There's also just the whole repressive and unfair, unequal situation of their entire life.
That was Katha Pollitt, Nation columnist and author of Pro from Picador. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Thank you.
That was some of the final movement, the really loud part, of Dmitri Shostakovich's Symphony No. 4, performed by the City of Birmingham Orchestra under Simon Rattle. Next up, Raquel Varela, a labor historian at the University of Lisbon and a researcher with the International Institute of Social History in Amsterdam. She's also the director of the political journal Revista Rubra. When I was in Lisbon in December 2013, I interviewed her about Portugal's economic crisis, an interview that was broadcast the following month. She's got a new book out, unfortunately only in Portuguese, whose title translates as Wither Portugal, so I thought it might be a good time to follow up with her. Greece has eclipsed the other peripheral European countries, but the effects of the euro crisis linger in the less prominent regions as well. According to orthodox economic indicators, Portugal's decline has been arrested, and there are even signs of growth returning. But as Raquel Varela will tell us, the orthodox indicators miss the story of how the crisis has affected public services and of its differential effects by class. Raquel Varela. People around the world have been paying a lot of attention to Greece, much less so to Portugal. So perhaps you can tell us, how has Portugal been faring? Has it recovered from its economic crisis?
Well, that's one of the things I discuss in this book, is the idea of crisis. What is a crisis? So I would say that there are important sectors of capital that are not in crisis anymore since 2008, 2009. And the workers and the pensionists are in a deep crisis with huge cuts of salaries and pension. But the number of millionaires has never been so big. There are also sectors of, I would say, small capitals that are in deep crisis with the raising of taxes, because the state basically nowadays has become a huge machine of collecting taxes to pay interest through the public debt that has raised with this money that was given to the banks from 70% to 130%. And so the state do not give back in services and production of goods for the society, but mainly the taxes are to pay this interest, which is a quite of a jackpot for these capitals that are invested in public debt. So we cannot say that there is a crisis of the country as a whole, because the country is deeply divided, so we shouldn't speak about a crisis of a country, but a crisis of class and fractions of classes, let's say it in a proper way.
So these rich folks, how are they making all this money? Who are they, and where are their fortunes coming from?
Well, there is no audit, for example, to the public debt. For the public-private partnerships that have huge profitable margins. Would you say this in English?
Yes, yes.
In a public-private partnership, in the highways, for example, can go to 14%. So which is, I mean, you just can find this in drug traffic. There's no other way you can have these margins of profit. It's really unbelievable. These are mainly economic groups have been created as monopolies, a dictatorship. So based on forced labor in the colonies and on very low salaries in Portugal, in the Portugal continent. And these groups, they have been consolidate their capital and their fortune through the privatization of the nationalized sector in the late 80s. So it's true that there was a nationalization and even expropriation of these groups during the Portuguese Revolution in 74-75. But this nationalization, as the state didn't change their hands after 75, after the counter-revolution started in 76, the state has used this money to create and consolidate huge companies in transport, communication, bank, insurance sectors. And all these companies were privatized in the late 80s, beginning of the 90s. And they were privatized without expensive workers, let's say it like this. So the workers with labor rights, with labor conditions, we are speaking about hundreds of thousands of workers, they went to pre-retirement situation or they got compensations, and all of this was paid by state social security and European Social Fund, which is, of course, taxpayer, paid by the European workers. And these companies became the typical Toyotist company. So they are companies which, with a very small amount of labor force and huge amounts of capital. And the labor force is a precarious, casual labor force in subcontract sectors. So these companies became very rich companies through this process.
So it sounds like they've essentially just gotten rich by looting state assets.
Yeah, exactly. So, and this is something we should be analyzing. We should analyze this question. We have always heard that capitalism was the best system to give goods to society because competition would finally lead to development, and development would lead to growth, and growth would lead to employment, and employment would lead to consumption of the working classes. So what we see now is that we live in a monopoly situation. There is no real competition, and the monopolies in the last, let's say, two decades, they are living directly, or let's say more than ever, with state subventions. And we shouldn't just look to the, let's say, the huge amount of money that was given directly to the state companies in 2007, 2008, but also to all this process as so-called public-private partnerships, subventions to the private sector. For example, in Portugal, 40% of the direct income of the private hospitals is coming from tertiarization or subcontracting system of the National Health Service, the public National Health Service. And so there are huge ways to privatize public income, and this is what has been done. So basically, an entire country has been being destroyed to save the value of the business that went bankrupt or should have been bankrupt in 2007, 2008, if the natural law of capitalism would work as it is. So,
now, I think an American economist would hear what you just said and say that what Portugal needs is competition. You're describing a regime of monopoly with state favoritism, and what you need to do is break up the monopolies and institute a regime of competition, like in the U.S. What would you say to that?
I would say that the U.S. is also a regime of monopoly. We live in a regime of monopoly in the last, since the First World War, and especially since after the Second World War. I mean, if you look to the world nowadays, we can choose between Pepsi Cola and Coca-Cola. That is the real competition. I mean, the biggest companies, all the technology sector in the world is controlled by three companies, Siemens, Philips, and General Electric. If you look to the car companies, how many car companies do you have in the world that really control the market? I don't know, 5, 6, maybe even less. How many companies built airplanes? And 70% of the workforce in the world that works in small and medium companies work directly for monopolies, these small and medium companies. So this is there is a very important intellectual who is he has been director of an academic journal, very interesting, called Critique, from Glasgow University. It's Professor Hillel Tiktin. He explains this very well in this theory of declining of capitalism. So the idea that in order you maintain profit, you have to destroy production, as it was never done before, except, of course, in the wars, in the First and the Second World War, where there was massive destruction of capital. But, for example, look to the transport sectors. There is a huge mess when you look to collective transports in the cities, due to the fact that these transports are private transports, they are not public transports, they are not free public transports. And the planning of these transports, the cost of these transports, the quality of the services of the transport, especially from the suburbs to the city centers, where there is a huge speculation of money throughout the property of the city centers, all of these have become destructive. So it is absolutely destructive from the point of view of humanity, of production goods, to have a system of controlling who pays and don't pay in the collective transports. You are spending efforts, energy, production in controlling people to see if they enter or not in the transport with a ticket. This transport should be absolutely free, paid by the taxis, and we shouldn't spend money on this. I'll give you a more concrete, maybe, example to explain how capitalism is destructive nowadays. For example, in Lisbon, 1/3 of the houses are empty, and in Oporto, they are empty. There's nobody living there, although there is homeless people, so many homeless people. And there is not a policy of rebuilding this property in the city center, but there is a company that is maintaining buildings that are in risk of ruin. Do you understand what I mean? So we spend money, we spend work, which is, I mean, it's a huge effort. We spend work to avoid that a house collapses in the middle of the street, but we don't spend money to rebuild this house for people to live there. This is, for example, very obvious in GDP. What GDP measures sometimes is destruction. For example, one of these days, a friend was giving a very interesting example. If there is a fire in a forest, the GDP can raise because you have been using energy for the cars, for the firemen cars. You have been using renting helicopters, chemicals to stop the fire, etc., etc. So if you use this appears in the GDP as something that has the meaning of growth. And what we had was destruction of the forest itself. So my point is that producing goods and services is not the same as producing profit. And producing profit can mean, in certain moments, that you are destroying goods and services. And that's what we are seeing in the last 5-6 years in a very dramatic way.
I'm speaking with the Lisbon-based labor historian Raquel Varela. Let's turn a bit to politics. We've seen in Greece, of course, Syriza take power in the government with mixed results, and a rise of oppositional forces in Spain. Podemos is rising to some degree. Even in Ireland, we see Sinn Féin acting a little more lively and militant. Has anything analogous been happening in Portugal?
No, not until now. What we have in Portugal, which is very clear, is a huge rate of abstention. But there is no effect on the five parties that are represented in the parliament. There is no relative effect, but there is an absolute effect since the abstention rate raises. So there are slightly differences, of course, between the what is here, the social democracy and the conservatives. And the left bloc has been split in 4 or 5 different parties. But we don't have until now anything similar to Greece and Spain, let's say mobilizing sectors that didn't believe in traditional parties, or totally destruction or disappearing of the traditional social democracy. We don't have that. I cannot say exactly why. I think there is a very complex explanation for this. First of all, Greece has entered in the crisis before that Portugal, and PASOK was in the government during the, let's say, the hard part of the austerity measures. And here, just the beginning of austerity measures were done by the Social Democrats. Then after that, they were done by the Conservatives. So I think somehow this has led to the idea that the Social Democrats can have an opportunity, if I make myself understood. Maybe this is one explanation. The other one is the traditional strongness of the Communist Party, which in Spain don't exist anymore. So this probably has led to a more stronger influence of Podemos. Also, the mobilizations in Spain were stronger. Spain also has the question of nationalities. So Spain has more, let's say, divisions between the fractions of the bourgeoisie with the question of Catalonia, the Basque Country, etc., which probably makes the state a little bit more fragile than in Portugal. In any case, I think, to be absolutely honest, and I developed this in the book, there will be a huge new wave of social conflicts, and the social democracy, the traditional social democracy, will not survive to this new wave of conflicts, because people are reaching a situation in Portugal where, let's say, that traditionally, not traditionally, but in the last 30 years, the casualization and the unemployment that reaches now 55 to 60% of the working people, the, let's say, around 60% of the working people is in the condition of a salary of biological reproduction. So they just can earn what is enough to reach the end of the month and pay houses and food, not more than that. So we are reaching a situation that it's not possible to avoid huge social conflicts, and the social democracy has nothing to give to this. So they don't even defend anymore a strong national sector, full employment policies. It's totally out of their programs.
Yeah, I was just reading the IMF, latest IMF report on Portugal, and they're talking about how we need more fiscal consolidation and that sort of thing, that the recovery is beginning to take hold, but we need more austerity, essentially. What kind of effect would that have in Portugal at this point, politically and economically, to continue the IMF program?
Well, the point is, I've tried to analyze this in this book, is to make in Portugal a China. It's to reindustrialize Portugal in a basis of very cheap labor. There is not any example in the contemporary history that this can be done without leading to social uprisings. You can have misery for, let's say, a long historical period in agrarian societies. You cannot have this in your urbanized, highly qualified and training societies. So so what the IMF is saying is that, okay, we have thousands of paper that will inside the European Central Bank that have no value if we don't cut pensions and salaries, because the losses of the capital in 2007-2008 are billions, are trillions. And we are going to pick up every drop that has left of your work to make of this paper real capital. But this is impossible to go on with this. What we are going to see is it's the raising of huge social conflicts. And the expectation is how the European working classes, and when I mean working classes, it's not that just the manual worker, it's the doctors, it's the teachers, it's the services, it's how wage labor will face the obvious and expectable disintegration of the euro and the European Union.
Do Portuguese people, Portuguese working class, look at what's happening in Greece and get any inspiration to resist the demands of the European Commission and the IMF, or does Greece seem far away and irrelevant?
Well, I think the Portuguese are really enthusiastic looking to Greece, really. And but in a way that concerns me a little bit. Let me try to see if my English is good enough to explain it. I think that the people in Europe are always looking to the neighbor to see if the neighbor has braveness to do what they don't want to do. So, oh, let's hope the Greeks start. Oh, let's hope the Spanish start. So I hope that the Portuguese start as well, as they have done in 74, finishing with the dictatorships in Southern Europe. And then, so for the people that are hearing us, we started a revolution against the dictatorship. And then the dictatorship immediately break down in Spain and in Greece in 74, 75. And I think we should... We should look to what can we do for the Greeks and not exactly just what can Greeks do for us. I think we should be more Europeans and less, oh, let's hope the neighbor will be, let's try someone to do the things for us.
Yes, as we say in American English, let George do it is the attitude, but it's time for the Portuguese to do it as well. All right, thank you very much. That was a Lisbon-based labor historian, Raquel Varela. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this bit from the much quieter conclusion to Shostakovich's Fourth Symphony, again with Simon Rattle conducting the Birmingham Orchestra. Till next week, bye.